That was the year.
Recreating notable events of passing time, reviving memories of men and women who have contributed to the history of a modern world.
That was the year. The White House, Washington, D.C., January 7th.
Mr. Gifford Pinchot, the Forest Service. Sir, by your own conduct, you have destroyed your usefulness as a helpful subordinate of the government, and it therefore now becomes my duty to direct the Secretary of Agriculture to remove you from your office as Forester. William H. Taft.
Thus did the hand of the chief executive reach across the presidential desk into the Department of Agriculture to lift zealous conservationist Pinchot up by the collar and drop him into a hotbed of controversy, later fanned into flames that resulted in the resignation of a member of Taft's cabinet. It had been Pinchot who had inspired Theodore Roosevelt to fight for conservation of the nation's natural resources. When President Taft appointed Richard Achilles Ballinger, Secretary of the Interior, it had been Pinchot who engineered bitter accusations against Ballinger. Charges that Ballinger was making it easy for the Guggenheim family to gain control of the government coal lands in Alaska. Ballinger, of course, refuted the charges in a voluminous report to Taft. Thereupon, it had been Pinchot who saw to it that the press received certain information from official government files, tending to further reflect upon Ballinger. After a congressional investigation lasting almost a year, Ballinger was vindicated. But in March of the following year, he tendered his resignation as a member of the cabinet, which the president accepted with the statement,
"I do not hesitate to say that you have been the object of one of the most unscrupulous conspiracies for the defamation of character that history can show."
1910, that was the year.
London, April 14, Prime Minister Herbert Henry Asquith addresses the closing session of the House of Commons.
"The government's effective existence depends upon the passing of the resolutions into law. If the House of Lords fails to accept or declines to consider our policy, the government will feel it their duty to advise the Crown as to what steps are necessary to ensure their policies receiving statutory effect. It would not be right for me to disclose the terms of that advice. But unless the government finds themselves in a position to give their policy statutory effect, they will either resign office or recommend the dissolution of Parliament."
Behind the scenes, leaders of all factions, liberals, conservatives, and Irish nationalists, knew that deft political bargaining would result in the eventual passing of Asquith's Parliament bill restricting the veto power of the House of Lords, a government's budget bill, and a relaxation of the government's antipathy toward home rule in Ireland. Said conservative leader Arthur Balfour,
"The nationalists have agreed to allow the budget in order to get home rule. The negotiations seem to me to have left both parties rather poorer than they were, and the government is paying a monstrous price for the budget."
And while this controversy ensued in England, the rumblings of rebellion against another far different sort of autocracy were being heard in the U.S. Congress.
For 7 years, Republican Joseph Gurney Cannon, as Speaker of the House of Representatives, and exercised almost complete dictatorial control of that body. Through interpretation of the 8 thick, baffling volumes of rules existing then, Cannon had power to appoint all committees. He had power to recognize on the floor those members whom he knew to be sympathetic toward his wishes. And he had power to refuse recognition to those members whom he knew to be insurgents or Democrats. From the meetings of Cannon-appointed committees, there were reported to the House only those bills which he favored. Those bills which he opposed were effectively chloroformed before they ever reached the floor of the House.
But on March 16, 1910, Cannon and his colleagues tried to mount a pedestal, which proved just a little too high. They attempted to abolish Calendar Wednesday, a day upon which members had slightly more individual powers than usual. And after the roll call the next day, his steel gray eyes flashing disapproval, Speaker Cannon was forced to announce,
"By vote of the House, the resolution is defeated. Recognizes the gentleman from Nebraska.
Mr. Speaker, I desire at this time to introduce another resolution."
From his inside pocket, insurgent member of the House George W. Norris extracted a thumbed, yellow, dog-eared sheaf of papers prepared months previously after tedious mastery of the House rules, but held in abeyance until the most propitious moment. This resolution proposed that members of the powerful Rules Committee be elected by the members, not appointed by the Speaker. A daring attempt to smash Cannon's power. After 29 hours of continuous debate, a vote was taken. The resolution was passed, 191 to 156. Thereupon, Cannon arose.
"The chair will entertain a motion to declare the office of Speaker of the House vacant."
No.
This unexpected move, however, was defeated, and Uncle Joe Cannon remained as Speaker of the House, but no longer the czar of his destiny, no longer the dictator of policy and legislation.
1910, that was the year.
Buckingham Palace, May 6th, to the Lord Mayor Mansion House. I am deeply grieved to inform you that my beloved father, the King, passed peacefully away at 11:45 tonight. Signed, George.
In the presence of Queen Alexandra, his children, and his personal physician, Edward VII relinquished his throne in death. The next day, the Prince of Wales became George V, and as tears fell upon the parchment he was reading, he concluded his address to the Privy Council.
"I have lost not only a father's love, but the affectionate and intimate relations of a dear friend and advisor."
1910. That was the year.
Hoboken, New York, August 9. The steamship Kaiser Wilhelm de Grosse lies alongside her pier as last-minute preparations are made for a transatlantic voyage. A shabbily clothed man approaches a clergyman on board.
"You're a pardon, Reverend."
"Yes?"
"Mayor Gaynor's on this boat, ain't he?"
"Yes, yes, he is. He's standing right over there in the center of that group, wearing a silk hat."
"Oh, a man with a white beard?"
"That's right. That's his honor."
"Thank you." "Mayor Gaynor! You'll rob me of my bread and butter."
"Look out, he's got a gun."
Departing on his first vacation since taking office, Mayor of New York William J. Gaynor was wounded seriously by a disgruntled, discharged city employee, James J. Gallagher. A vigorous, hardy constitution helped his recovery, and Mayor Gaynor once more took up his official duties. But 3 years and 1 month later, September 10, 1913, crossing the Atlantic again to enjoy a European vacation, Mayor Gaynor died at sea on board the steamship Baltic.
1910. That was the year.
"Say, Tom, let me whitewash a little."
No, I reckon it'd hardly do, Ben. You see, Aunt Polly's awful particular about this fence, right here in the street, you know. But if it was the back fence, well, I wouldn't mind, and she wouldn't. Yeah, she's awful particular about this fence. It's got to be done very careful. Why, I reckon there ain't one boy in 1,000, maybe 2,000, that can do it the way it's got to be done."
"Is that so? Oh, come on now. Let me just try. Only just a little. I'd let you if you was me, Tom."
"Ben, I'd like to. Honest Injun, but Aunt Polly... Well, Jim wanted to do it, but she wouldn't let him. Sid wanted to do it, and she wouldn't let Sid. Now, don't you see how I'm fixed? If you was to tackle this fence and anything was to happen..."
"Oh, shucks. I'll be just as careful. Let me try. Say, I'll give you the core of my apple.
Well, here. No, Ben, now don't. I'm afeard.
I'll give you all of it.
Tom gave up the brush with reluctance in his face, but alacrity in his heart, and sat on a barrel in the shade close by, dangled his legs, munched his apple, and planned the slaughter of more innocents.
On April 21, Samuel Langhorne Clemens, known throughout the world as Mark Twain, creator of Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn, Becky Thatcher, Aunt Polly, and all the beloved characters of his prolific imagination, writer of A Connecticut Yankee, The Prince and the Pauper, Innocents Abroad, died at Redding, Connecticut, at the age of 74. Later that year, Mary Baker Eddy, founder of Christian Science and recipient of much of the caustic criticism from the pen of Mark Twain, died at her home in Boston, at the age of 90.
1910, that was the year.
And one of the hit songs of that year was first published, since to become a perennial favorite.
When the town is fast asleep and it's midnight in the sky, that's the time the festive cheer starts to reach his other eye. Starts to wink his dreamy eye. There's a million in a time. Chinatown, my Chinatown, where the lights are low. Hearts that know no other land.
Other land, dreaming, true and known.
Dreamy, dreamy Chinatown. Almond eyes are proud. Hearts in light and lights in bright. In dreamy Chinatown. Strangers taking in the sight. Pigtails flying here and there. See that broken Wall Street score. Still thinks he's a millionaire.
Dreamy Chinatown.